Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we continue to explore the cultures of consciousness. Last night, I watched a just terrific documentary, highly, highly recommended, from a few years ago, called Leviathan, from Harvard's Sensory Ethnography Lab. And what they did with this remarkable piece of film is go out for 20-hour stretches on these grueling fishing expeditions off of New Brunswick in what looks to be terribly unpleasant weather, and use a series of GoPro cameras to attach these cameras to all variety of objects that are associated with this expedition. There's no voiceover. There's no information. You don't get to meet the characters. Instead, you're plunged into the water. You're plunged in with the fish as they're hacking them apart. You're going in and out of the sea. The seagulls are swimming by, the chains, the clanking. It's an extraordinary film because it really sort of tells a story or captures an encounter, a whole set of encounters between things, including human things, but not necessarily mostly human things. So we see humans interacting with the ship and sort of talking. We can kind of understand what they're saying part of the time. So it's a surreal, bizarre, and in a way a kind of a horror movie, not just because the gruesomeness of some of the fish processing, but really a kind of sense, a spectral sense of disturbing presences of the water, of the chains, of the clanking, of the birds, of the fish, who are all named by their species as sort of characters in the film at the end of the film. And they even use a little kind of heavy metal gothic font for the film. And so they're going for a certain sort of horror, but it's not a horror of monsters so much, or rather it's the horror of the monstrous that is close to us, the objects, the weirdness, the things that we encounter every day. And I watched this film partly because I knew that today I was going to be speaking with Tim Morton, who is a philosopher and writer, and he does both well, which is nice and rare. And he is associated with a sort of movement, or I wouldn't say a school because it's too diverse, but a sort of sensibility, a contemporary philosophical sensibility that is sometimes called speculative realism or object-oriented ontology. Some people will say those aren't quite exactly the same things, but let's just go with it for now. But at the core of this sensibility is a sense that we live in a world in which there are real objects, gazillions of them, and that indeed life consists of a constant sort of interaction between objects that nonetheless always remain sort of obscure to one another. So rather than think of things as existing only in the human mind or only in scientific tables, things actually really exist, but they're mysterious and foreclosed. And so there's a kind of uncanniness or weirdness about these objects. And this has led Tim in, especially to take on some really fascinating approaches to ecology and the questions of ecology in the era of climate change, in the era of hyper-technologization and increasing awareness of our place in the evolutionary course of the universe, and has led him to put forward some bold statements like or notions like the idea that at this point we no longer need the concept of nature, and in fact it gets in the way of ecological thinking and proper environmentalist response. So he stirs up some of the kind of existing frameworks of environmentalist thought, raising some questions about some of the romanticism, some of the holistic or process-oriented thinking that is often associated with environmentalism, and he does so in the name of the sort of uncanny return, not just of objects like fish and fishing boats, but what he calls hyper-objects, which are objects that are so spread across time and space, they're so enormous and so complex, that we really can't conceive of them in any really coherent way. And the great example here is climate change, that what's happening on a global scale across immense periods of time that's already with us and yet somehow strangely invisible, appearing, disappearing. Is it in the raindrops? Is it behind the raindrops? I can't really tell. Or since I'm talking from California, the absence of raindrops, though it looks like it might actually drop a few today. He's really introduced some powerful ways of thinking about ecology. But in addition to all this, which already makes him close to my heart, particularly because he is an excellent writer, but in addition to this, and far more refreshing for me, Tim speaks quite openly and directly about Buddhism in a very, very fresh and exciting way. As someone who has spent a lot of time on the pillow and in Buddhist texts and has in the past gotten rather tired of the discourse of contemporary American Buddhism, in fact, actually actively sick of it in many ways. It's been incredibly refreshing to read his latest publication, which is an essay in a book called Nothing. And this marvelous book, which has essays as well by Marcus Boone and Eric Kasdan, it's called Nothing, Three Inquiries in Buddhism, and it's an attempt to think Buddhism in a different way, using the ideals of critical thought, taking on Marxist and other criticisms of Buddhism that are contemporary and widespread within critical thinking, and attempting to think Buddhism in a different and new way for our condition. And this essay by Tim's in this book, actually the whole book is great, but Tim's essay in particular is really startling and marvelous, and has enabled me to rethink a lot of the roles that these thoughts and practices and experiences play in trying to think our way through a very weird world. So this is all making Timothy Morton definitely one of my favorite philosophers, and I'm very happy that you joined us on Expanding Mind. Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, my gosh, and I'm very happy that you introduced me so nicely, and I've got a new idea, which is that you should be writing all of my stuff now. It would be incredibly convenient. You've actually done a much better job than I can do explaining it, which is just fantastic, so thank you for that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a very resonant set of concepts and ideas, and you know what, just off the top of my head, I mean, one of the things that I really love about your work is your substantive use of the word weird, which also, as I've mentioned to you and listeners, plays a role in my recently completed dissertation called High Weirdness, in which I also try to add some heft to this concept, which has been sort of sneaking in from the edges, both in philosophy in general, and particularly around some speculative realism. You know, Graham Harman, who inspired you greatly, and his books I also think are wonderful to read, and they're also fun to read, like Tim's book. He also makes a turn towards the weird. He talks about Lovecraft. He talks about Cthulhu. He talks about the weirdness of objects. And this quality of weirdness is becoming increasingly significant to me. It's something that I also experienced watching the film last night, where it's this proximity to things that are both very familiar, all too familiar, maybe too close almost, and at the same time something that is very peculiar about them. So just since we're on it, tell me a little bit about weird and how you watch that word and that concept kind of creep into your experiences and thoughts.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm so glad that you described the object-oriented ontology that I like to think about. And I'm really glad that you said, yeah, we live in a universe of real objects. But the point to remember about these objects is that they're not your granddaddy's object. They're weird objects. What does that mean? Well, weird, first of all, it comes from the old Norse word urt, yeah? And this word is a word that's also given to the name of one of the Norns, the Fates, who sort of entwine the web of fate in their sort of indigenous culture there. And this word urt literally means twisted or looped, in a loop, yeah? And I think this is a very interesting way of thinking about pretty much everything. You know, spoons, thoughts, quasars, mermaids, dolphins, black holes, global warming, Eric Davis. Have you ever heard of Eric Davis? I should introduce you to him one day. The point is that things are weird because they're twisted into themselves in the following way. Things are exactly what they are, but they are never how they appear. There's a sort of fundamental crack in them that you can't point to, a crack that you can't point to. It's what we call a transcendental gap. It's there, but you can't point to it. So let's take the example of a black hole, which is sort of the easiest one because it's the most dense object in the universe, right? Nothing can escape from the black hole, right? It's completely solidly, not solidly, but it's profoundly dense, right? And yet, and at the same time, it emits something. This is Stephen Hawking's big discovery, right? It emits this Hawking radiation. And so eventually, even a black hole that nothing else can kind of hit will evaporate under its own steam. And this difference between the black hole as such and how the black hole appears, which is this kind of tiny quantized radiation that it's emitting, is what is actually causing this object, this black hole, to be a fragile entity, right? So it's not the case that I'm a solid person with I'm Tim Morton written all the way through my structure, and that, you know, a bigger, badder thing with I'm a bigger, badder thing written all the way through its structure is going to come and destroy me. What's more like the case is that I myself am fragile because I'm made up of all kinds of things that aren't me. And this is because, ontologically speaking, there's a profound gap between what I am and how I appear. And that's how something could destroy me, because I'm already a little bit fragile. It's weirdly like what some mathematicians say about logical systems. If you've ever studied the work of Gödel, for example, in the book Gödel-Escher-Bach by Douglas Hofstadter, it's very beautiful. It's basically saying that in order to be coherent, in other words, in order to be true on its own terms, a logical system has to be able to talk the kind of thing that comes out of a bowl that I might not be able to say on the radio, or maybe I can. So the point is that in order to be coherent, a logical system must also be able to be talk nonsense, actually. So it's a very peculiar situation, because the existence of this logical system depends upon its inner fragility. It cannot be consistent all the way through. And I think this is because entities in general can't be consistent all the way through. And that's because they're weird. Now, what's weird about an entity with a transcendental gap between what it is and how it appears? Well, because you can't point to the gap, right? Because you can't ever find that gap in, you know, another technical term, ontically given. In other words, like in the world of data, in the world of perception, you can't find this gap. Because of that, a thing is kind of like a Möbius strip. If you take a piece of paper and a strip of paper and you twist it once and like fold it into itself, it forms an interesting object that has one side or two sides, depending on how you think about it. If you take a little walk along the outside of the strip, you suddenly find yourself on the inside. If you take a walk on the inside of the strip, you suddenly find yourself on the outside. And you start to think to yourself, now, when did I get from the inside to the outside? When did that flip occur as I went around that Möbius strip? And the point is, it's occurring everywhere. The twist in the strip is everywhere in the strip. In the same way, the difference between what I am and how I appear is everywhere in me. And so I'm twisted. Everything is twisted. Everything's a little bit bent. There's no such thing as a straight thing. And I kind of mean that in a kind of sexuality sense as well. So
interesting resonance between weird and queer. I think it's something that remains to be worked out. What I also really like about the presentation is this notion of there's this radical gap between appearances and, let's say, the inside or the interior, the thing itself. And yet those things are constantly unstable, the relationship between them. And it creates a very lively space of these interacting appearances. This space
yes, it does.
But even more.
Yes, it does, because you see, the thing is, we normally think of things, you know, we normally hear what I just said to mean things are kind of like lumps, and these lumps exist underneath the kind of rather superficial candy sort of that gives them a color and a texture and all that kind of jazz. That's your granddaddy's object, right? This kind of object is sparklingly vivid all the way through, because you cannot distinguish between what it is and how it appears, and yet those things are different in the same way that a Möbius strip has one side and two sides at the same time. So what does this kind of mean? It means that things don't actually sort of mechanically touch each other. They influence each other in a dimension that we're familiar with when we walk into an art gallery, that is the aesthetic dimension, like how things work in quantum theory or even in relativity theory, where space-time isn't a box that things are sitting in, but is in fact a kind of liquid that's kind of coming out of objects, right? So the point is that causality itself is in the realm of appearance. That's something that we've known, actually, in philosophy and indeed in science for the last 200 years, but I think we're just beginning to be able to kind of live that idea.
Can you break that down a little bit more?
Yeah.
I know that it took me a little time, and I'm not even sure I totally get it.
Sure.
That just this idea of that causality is happening not in the mechanical billiard ball realm that we're all familiar with from high school physics, but it's happening in an aesthetic space. What does that mean? What does it mean to be talk about aesthetics or define aesthetics in that context that helps illuminate that interaction?
Yeah, well, as well as objects being twisted, I'm kind of twisted, Eric, and I like to kind of twist things together that seem to be very different, and that's one reason why in many social and professional situations I seem to come across as the devil. I wrote this thing about, ecology without nature, and clearly a lot of people react to that quite strongly, and I find myself in this position of kind of saying counterintuitive things all the time. So let me say a very counterintuitive thing, which is that, yes, causality is kind of like happening in a kind of art space, right? We think of art as a kind of decoration thing, really, that's kind of on top of causality, but really causality is in front of stuff, just like how, you know, we feel about a painting is kind of in front of the painting, you know, it's kind of coming out of the painting, and we're in front of it. This is because it's actually very simple. It's just that we haven't actually caught up with what Hume did in the late 18th century and what Kant did to kind of underwrite Hume. But what it means is that fundamentally causality is like telekinesis, which is one reason why, again, we've kind of blocked this idea. Because we don't like this, or at least officially, we don't like the idea of the sort of paranormal, which is something that we've also been, you know, in the West beginning to explore and think about since the later 18th century. So Hume argues successfully that, when a billiard ball hits another billiard ball, there it is hitting the billiard ball, but you can't actually infer from that that it's going to cause that every single time you see it. Maybe the millionth, billionth time that happens, it's not going to happen that way. All you have is data, right? And causality is actually something that you infer from the data. That's just contemporary science. Contemporary science is like religiously forbidden from making statements about what reality actually is. All it can see is patterns in data, right? And so what science is really about is looking at patterns. It's not really about looking at reality, funnily enough. That's the job of humanistic disciplines. And the job of art, counterintuitively, is actually directly messing with cause and effect. When you're doing a piece of art, you're basically being like some kind of shaman. You are directly messing with causality. So we know that, you know, quantum theory is like the most powerful logical way of explaining how things work so far. And according to this view, things don't really touch one another. They sort of influence each other in a rather different way, which Einstein was quite disturbed about. He called it spooky action at a distance. That phrase itself should suggest to you sort of some kind of idea of telekinesis, right? Now, the point is that clearly we can feel things and touch things and hold things, and things can touch us, right? Ontologically, they can't touch because they are fundamentally withdrawn from one another. And so they have to influence each other some other way, right? And the way they influence each other is in this weird kind of appearance realm. Now, since this appearance realm goes all the way down and through a thing, it's not the same thing as saying that things are kind of lumps, kind of waiting to things, waiting for other things to happen to them. It's more like we're living in a radically paranormal universe in which, you know, it's not simply us that is having the fun of kind of like influencing stuff in a non-local way. It's that everything is doing that. When a snowflake falls on a hot rock, it's also somehow strangely interacting with that rock in a way that doesn't completely exhaust the rock. It makes a kind of snowflake translation of the rock, and the rock makes a kind of rocky translation of the snowflake. And the way that we, you know, have become used to talking about art is actually how we should be talking about causality. It's just that we find this very, very hard to accept, and we can find this experience, which is profoundly disturbing, at least to sort of white Western people.
I wanted to mention to folks that you have a lot of your ideas about aesthetics are also available in this very interesting publication that you did with Bjork, where you guys started an email conversation, and it's a really delightful one to see how your ideas sort of are kind of charged and activated by artists who are definitely working in this kind of realm where, whether you're thinking about her kind of biophilia model or even just the way she uses the studio or uses her voice, where she's bringing something beyond the kind of familiar realm of the human, the familiar world of the human, and even as being a huge pop star, she still managed to pull it off where there are elements of her work where you're really in a space you could call it experimentalism if you wanted to, but it's really a space where you're not really sure where the boundaries of the human are, because in a way those are too overcoded.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is kind of like what happens to David Hume, actually. Immanuel Kant comes along, and he gives you the reason why this strange thing is happening, which is that all of a sudden all we have is data. You know, like Hume later on became the bass guitarist of Pink Floyd, and he wrote a lyric, all you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. And it's disturbing because all of a sudden, wait a minute, dude, who stole my reality? You know, can I do anything now? Because, you know, my idea of, you know, having a good time is slicing your throat, and even though you think that's being killed, I think that's making a nice painting, right? If everything is just a bundle of associations, then can I get away with anything? Can anything happen? And Kant's obviously disturbed by this, because it's obviously not true, because a strawberry is definitely a strawberry. It's just that the strawberry data, you know, the juiciness, the sourness, the redness, whatever else, is never the strawberry. It's strawberry data. Like, say, for example, the strawberry went on Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah was interviewing the strawberry because for some reason it was a sort of Muppet strawberry that could talk. What the strawberry would say about itself, you know, I found myself in the middle of a conversation between Eric Davis and Tim Morton, and it was very disturbing that I suddenly came to awareness in this way. All the stuff that it said about itself would be a strawberry's autobiography. It wouldn't be a strawberry. It would be an autobiography. Do you see what I'm saying? And so the thing is, even the strawberry can't fully know what the strawberry is because of this difference between the strawberry data, the strawberry phenomena, and the actual strawberry. On the other hand, it's a strawberry. It's not a banana, right? So we're in a very weird situation where things definitely are what they are, and they have definitely their phenomena. But nevertheless, there's this kind of weird mystery quality about things. Now, the trouble with scientism as opposed to science is that it's always trying to delete this mystery, right? And a lot of philosophy is also trying to delete the mystery as if the mystery was a kind of a mistake. But object-oriented ontology is saying this mystery is actually hardwired into how things are. And when you delete it, when you try to delete it, which is impossible, so when you try to delete it, it's called violence, because it's never going to work. And this violence could be philosophical violence, but it could also be social violence or gender violence or any kind of physical violence, in fact. And, you know, ecologically, we've been trying to kind of delete the anomalous qualities of things for quite a long time. It's called contemporary agricultural civilization, unquote, you know, civilization for short. In other words, what we think we've been doing for the last 12,500 years. You see, it goes way, way back before any, you know, named Western philosopher. This tendency we have to kind of try to shave the kind of weird appearances off of things and get down to kind of some kind of nice lump that we can manipulate how we want, right? And it had to do with a kind of fear of climate change, because the Holocene was beginning and Earth was warming a little bit, and the hunter-gatherers were like, oh my God, where's my next meal coming from? Because all the animals just kind of scooted off in some other direction. I know, let's settle down and farm and kind of control stuff, you know, in a kind of Finding Nemo sort of Dory kind of just keep swimming sort of away, and maybe it'll work, right? And it didn't work. It didn't work from almost the get-go. It resulted in patriarchy. It resulted in massively oppressive social hierarchies. And actually, a lot of people were very, very hungry. But by that point, somehow this kind of default logic had been hardwired, not just into people's brains, but into social space. This logic in which just existing is always better than any quality of existing, because as we remember just from what I just said, existing kind of is underneath appearing, according to this model, and so it's better than, it's more fundamental than how things appear. And now we know, right? Now we know. Now we've wash, rinse, repeated this procedure for 12,500 years. Now it covers the whole of Earth's surface, and it requires industry and huge social forms like neoliberal capitalism to make it work. We can see what it is, which is a massive cosmic disaster that is really toxic to all life forms.
Yes, you know what? And then I want to get more into the disaster and the current situation of climate change. Mm. But we're going to take a break here. We're talking with Timothy Morton on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking with philosopher and writer Timothy Morton. Tim, we just sort of introduced the massive, catastrophic marvel mm-hmm. that is our moment just before the break there. And I want to see how this idea of objects, this idea of appearances, plays in directly to our contemporary situation, and particularly the situation of climate change. I want to give you one little riff that I took away from your work that's really helped me, and I think everybody experiences this, is that there's no longer a normal conversation about the weather. It is impossible to have a conversation with your random person, which was one of the main conversations that one would have to stitch together social space with strangers in the area you live. You might talk about sports, maybe you talk about politics, probably not, and you can certainly talk about the weather. But now, any conversation about the weather, however banal, is ghosted, loomed over by this larger kind of impossible, in your term, hyper-object of climate change. But we don't know where to locate it. Like speaking as a Californian, I know that droughts, dryness is common historically to this area. We cannot blame the entirety of the drought on global warming. And yet, many signs point to the severity of the current drought as being deeply related, because, of course, it's all related and we're in a new zone. So any conversation about the drought is also a conversation about climate change, but in a way that's very hard to locate. So it creates a sense of uncanniness. A kind of horror movie. Something is, there's a ghost in the room, but we can't get there, because you can never say this drought, this rainstorm, this typhoon is climate change.
Yeah.
There's this fundamental split, which reminds me of this is the split you're talking about ways.
Yeah, I love that you said the word ghosted. I think in general that what things are sort of like the X-Men, right? Let's think about evolution for a minute. When you stop the clock of evolution, stop the tape of evolution, at any moment you'll find a species that is ghosted by its sort of X species, not EX, but capital X, like in the X-Men species variant of itself. So, for example, here we have this fish, but this particular fish has this superpower, and the superpower is that it can jump out of water and breathe for a couple of minutes on dry land, right? Several million years later, we look back on that and we go, oh, that's the beginning of amphibians. But at that moment, it's just a mutation, right? When you look at evolution on a step-by-step basis, it has no forward gear at all. It's not teleological. It's not going anywhere. It's all just mutation. And so a fish is also an X-fish at the same time. It's this actual fish, but it's ghosted in your language by an X fish, right? In the same way, the weather, you know, is ghosted by this other thing, this kind of X weather, right, if you think about it, or the conversation about the weather is ghosted by an X conversation about something more weird and profound, say, for example, the notion of climate, you know, or indeed talking about global warming, right? And so we find ourselves in a situation where suddenly science can see this stuff. It can see these massive, huge, weird things that ghost things. Like, science can see evolution, right? But when you try to look for evolution, what you find are individual, you know, cats and chimps and humans, right? When you try to see climate, what you find is weather. And so the big problem is James Inhofe can come along with a snowball and say, look, see, it's not, there's no global warming, right? And there's a fundamental way in which he's kind of trying to party like it's 1749 there, because he's trying to ignore the last 200 years of philosophy, where precisely we've found that there's this incredible gap between what things are and how they appear. We're just beginning to see that this is correct, right? Because there are these very, very big things, and we're inside these big things, right? And when we're inside a thing, it's very hard to be completely right about it or to do something completely right. So we're inside this big thing called biosphere, and we're inside this big thing called climate, right? And it's impossible to get the right angle on it, either in terms of like seeing it right or in terms of acting about it right. So, for example, you know, I'm going to drive a Prius, which I do. Obviously, that's not going to save Earth, right? But also, not driving a Prius is not going to save Earth, and definitely not putting wheels on a leaf blower and driving the leaf blower around in a cynical statement about how we're all doomed and nothing we can ever do will ever save Earth, which is a kind of environmental discourse that's also a kind of a right-wing discourse in another way, is also not going to save Earth, right? It's kind of like the old Kierkegaardian thing that against God, we're always in the wrong, you know. I find this idea very relaxing. It basically means that we're all hypocrites. And fundamentally, that kind of means that since we can never get anything perfectly right, everything that we do is kind of slightly disjointed and lame. And that's also because things in general are slightly disjointed and lame. There's always a weird kind of crack in them, like I've been trying to say, right? And so we're just beginning to notice this weirdness. Now, what is the word for a weird thing that is ghosted by a kind of weird, uncanny X version of itself? Well, one word is trickster. And, you know, first peoples have this down, right? They don't have a concept of nature. They don't have a concept of ontologically stable things that are straightforwardly exactly what they are. When they encounter beings, they think of them in a slightly paranoid way. Like, is this bunny rabbit actually a demon trying to confuse me? Or maybe its left ear is a sort of portal to another dimension. Or maybe just this hair on its left ear is the weird demonic thing, and the rest of the bunny rabbit is okay. And I can't really know in advance, and so I have to kind of be careful how I treat this bunny rabbit, because maybe it could be something else. It might be an ex-bunny rabbit, I don't know. And so, like, in a way, all animals are kind of spirit animals, right? Now, the ironic thing is that we've gotten there through data. We've gotten there through science. We've gotten there through trying to eliminate contradictions. And so the funny thing is that we've backed into this ecological awareness age in which we've discovered, OMG, we never actually exited the Paleolithic. We've gone nowhere in the last 12,500 years in our attempt to straighten things out and shave things down and get things down to sort of basic stuff that we can manipulate. What we've done is create an even worse version of the material conditions we were trying to avoid. And so we've kind of gone nowhere, and we've also gone nowhere cognitively, because we've suddenly beginning to realize, but now with a lot of footnotes and incredible articles published in Nature Physics, that actually things really are tricksters. So I find this ironic, and it's ironic in a kind of twisty way. It's like being in Blade Runner, right? It's like the detective Deckard who suddenly realizes, I am one of the, you know, criminals that I'm looking for. I myself am an android, right? And ecological awareness is like that. It has this necessarily twisty, uncanny quality, and sort of trying to think of it as this completely untwisted way of just looking directly at nature is actually not it.
I want to ask you a little bit about that, because when I hear you talk about the trickster element and really about weird objects in general, for me this resonates with an interest I have in animism and a new animism, even in its fully kind of indigenous sense. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people feel that, and I think a lot of people who are invested in ecology, in ecological thinking, in environmentalism, have a certain opening towards that sort of realm of enchantment. At the same time, many of these people, probably to some degree, and this is including myself, unreflectively, hold on to the concept of nature. And of course, one of your more, you know, pugnacious statements is that, you know, nature doesn't, is kind of a shitty concept, and it gets in the way, and it's actually causing some trouble. And because I think this is such an important idea to put out there, and not just in a lame post-structuralist, oh, well, nature's a construct, it has a history, you have to understand it, that it was used by bad people to do bad things, which is a kind of thinking we're very familiar with and is now sort of just, you know, running on empty in a lot of ways. You're saying something more substantial about the trouble with the concept of nature.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I kind of lobbed a grenade, you know, and then I sort of walked away calmly whistling while the building exploded and everyone ran around tearing their hair out, and it was very naughty of me. And like I say, I'm the devil. So nature, okay. Nature is a concept that is kind of developed in the agricultural age by default, whether it's called nature or not, right? It's this idea of something that's kind of over there, right? It's always kind of past the city, through the gates of the city, over the field. You got to walk across this stream, and then you find yourself in nature. Or it's in my DNA. It's underneath me. It's like, here's Tim, but like underneath Tim somewhere is natural, whatever that is, right? So it's never directly here. It's always kind of over there underneath, kind of underwriting what's happening here. And if you think about it, that's actually a kind of agricultural age distinction, right? Here I am with my farm, and here I am in my city with my farm surrounding the city. And outside that is what we call nature. And usually at that moment, it's seen as sort of hostile and threatening. And sort of when it impinges on me, I'm going to call it weed or pest, and I'm going to try to eliminate it, right? Or, you know, the upside down kind of romantic version, I'm going to idealize it, right? And so the thing is that nature is kind of, it's not really about coral, right? It's not that I don't believe in coral. It's that I do believe in coral. I do think that the coral is real. Therefore, I don't think it's natural, because I think coral is twisted, and what is natural is supposed to be sort of untwisted and straight and kind of regular. The other trouble, of course, with nature, and this is my first take on it, the other trouble, of course, is that it's kind of been used as a way to fight modernity. But of course, the trouble is, I've just tried to explain, it's kind of like a piece of what got us into modernity. So you're kind of trying to fight a virus with a piece of the virus itself, and it's not quite working. And it's also kind of like using a, you know, like a sort of fake medieval rubber sword against like a tank. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can say nature, but this oncoming massive neoliberal kind of global tank is still going to run you over, right? How do you disable the tank, right? One of the ways to disable the tank, actually, is to drop this concept of nature, which is actually getting in the way of caring about non-human beings. Let's think about it another way. Non-human beings are already in social space. It's kind of obvious, right? There's bacteria in my nose, which I just blew into this handkerchief, and you know, I put the handkerchief on the table. That's all happening in social space. There's bacteria in social space, right? There's bunny rabbits and cats and whatever. What does that mean? That kind of means that social space was never completely human in the first place, and so therefore, you know, there's no real boundary, right? There's no real difference between where I'm living and like where all the other critters are living. And so kind of ecological awareness is that, right? It's noticing that, funnily enough, nature, whatever that is, isn't this thing that's over there, you know, whatever that is, it's kind of in my face. It is my face, right? At that point, you don't have to use the word, right? Because if it's everything as it completely impinges on me, you know, in the most intimate possible way, then there's no distinction anymore. And nature is only really a concept that works in what we call a normative way. In other words, it's used to discriminate between stuff that's authentic and stuff that's inauthentic, or stuff that's good and stuff that's bad. Now, if everything is nature, then you can't discriminate, right? So it loses its power, right? So once you've figured that out, right, that social space is always already full of non-humans, and, you know, furthermore, I would argue cognitive space and philosophical space, all these different kinds of space, are also populated by non-human beings. You can just like relax and you can kind of drop this concept of nature, which in a way is sort of inhibiting a more intimate engagement with those non-human beings.
I want to stay with this idea of intimacy. One of my favorite lines in your book, Hyper Objects, is you talk about something about what happens when we lose the world or lose a world, and what remains is intimacy. And you're talking there about the sense that we have humans like to craft their little bubbles of a world. Like, so I'm in a world with non-humans. I'm not really paying that much attention to all the non-humans that are in my social space, except when it's convenient for me or it fits into my local human reality that has narrative and history, and it's very it's just very human focused. And suddenly, what happens when those worlds start to dissolve, or when they break down, or when you see their emptiness? And then suddenly you realize that you're where you're sitting right now at this conjunction of a myriad of relationships and encounters gleaning off that are profoundly inhuman and can be terrifying. You know, and like you use the wonderful Zizek example of the toilet. Mm-hmm. You know, like we have this toilet in our house, and then I do my business and I pull the trigger and it disappears. It goes through some bent, some warp, and it goes into another world that's outside of, or another place that's outside of my world. So my world's boundaries are sustained. But of course, if you actually think about it, where does it go? What happens to this waste treatment? And then suddenly I realize that doesn't actually exist. Mm-hmm. My little world that I'm trying to protect with my toilet doesn't really exist. Yeah. And so now suddenly, oh my God, I'm out of the world. And rather than worlding, But not just being terrified in that place, there's also something like intimacy. And when you said that, when you use that phrase, it rings a lot of Buddhist bells in me as well. And so I'd love to hear you talk about what does it mean to be in intimacy with objects?
Yeah, let's go there, because you see, of course, the thing is, it's terrifying to us, right? It's terrifying to like white Western in particular, kind of. I would like to probably say guys, maybe that's a bit controversial, but I think you can only be kind of truly horrified for a few seconds before it begins to look a little bit old. The uncanny, right? When Freud talks about uncanniness, what he's really talking about is the fact that you came out of your mum's, you know, vagina, you know, and there's only so many times you can be freaked out by that before it begins to look a little bit like slightly sexist in a rather corny way. In other words, like when you begin to relax, when you begin to notice that this is actually the way things are, you know, and you just were born and you were in a uterus and that's actually fine. When you start to notice this thing that kind of like is pretty obvious to other people on the planet, then it becomes sort of different, right? It's sort of like when you're in the middle of a nightmare, it could be so scary that at first you start to laugh, right? At some point it becomes a little bit funny. It becomes a little bit silly, right? And then you find yourself in a kind of lower level, lower stimulation level kind of depression space, maybe, like where you're literally being pressed down and like impinged upon by all these beings, and you can't peel them off you quickly enough to get rid of them. And you've accepted that, right? You sort of just relax, right? You're in this kind of melancholic, kind of gothy space, right? And then you kind of realize that actually, you know, what's really happening underneath that is there's some obvious kind of basic connection between me, this human being, and these non-human beings. And yet I can't grasp these non-human beings because they are intrinsically ungraspable in the way that we were talking about at first. And so there's this kind of intrinsic sadness, right? Like the like the horror melted into some kind of sense of the ridiculous, and the ridiculous melted into this melancholia, and the melancholia melted into this sadness, right, which is also equivalent to the experience of beauty, right? Now, then you kind of begin to realize where this sadness is being fueled by something. What's it being fueled by? It's being fueled by this longing. I want to reach out to grasp. I want to hold. I want to, you know, it's your Buddhist kind of, you know, second noble truth. Like we live in this realm, you know, which some texts call the desire realm. That's like the energy of this realm. It's how things work, right? And you can't really delete it, but you can have different positions on it, and you can think, maybe I need to hold on really tight, you know, or maybe actually I can sort of trust, you know, and I can sort of let go and allow things to kind of disappear from me and come towards me and disappear from me and kind of like never be completely graspable, right? And then I'm having a more kind of intimate relationship with them. And one of these things that you can have a weird intimate relationship with is called your mind, right? And what happens when you meditate, of course, is that you realize that when you look directly at your mind, it kind of weirdly disappears, like the soap in the bath, right? It's there, but it's kind of gone, because actually it's not something that you can grasp. It's real, it's right there, but you can't hold on to it. So there's this funny kind of experience that's like a feeling of evaporation. It's not like there's nothing, right? It's not like you're in completely the void. Actually, there's something, but it's not your granddaddy's something. It's what in some texts is called Buddha nature, right? There's this kind of ethereal kind of energy flow, and it's not exactly me, you know, and there's something slightly sad and spooky about it. But inside the sad and spooky is this unconditional joy, actually. There's this sort of chili-flavored droplet of joy inside the liquid cherry sort of sadness center of this chocolate of ecological awareness. It's like a chocolate, right? The outer coating is guilt, you know, and that's still kind of dualistic. And then inside that we have shame. And then inside the shame, as a condition of possibility for having shame, we have horror, right? And then inside the horror, we have melancholia. And then inside the melancholia, we have the sadness. And inside the sadness, we have the longing. And inside the longing, we have the joy. And so the point is, like, instead of, like, trying to delete these different states, what I've learned from Buddhism is that you sort of let them happen, and you sort of go with them, and you sort of explore what could be sort of the encrypted, frozen wisdom inside the confusion. Inside the confusion, trying to delete the confusion makes it more confusing.
Yeah, so absolutely. For me, one of the strongest images in your work of this kind of position you're talking about is the charnel ground. You know, I've always been fascinated with that aspect of Buddhism, and I've brought that mind into my own experiences, particularly of horror, of nightmares, of profound loneliness, of paranoid despair, and to not flee from that as well with the mind of the meditator in the charnel ground. And I think that image also, there's something open about it in a way that just looking at our current condition as a grief space, or as a pure space of kind of guilt or suffering in relationship to all of the things that humans have done, and now we're in the situation, everything's spinning out of control, here we go, hold on to your hats. Yeah. But the charnel ground still, to my mind, maybe because of its tantric overlay, has possibilities in it that seem to me better than just thinking about grief and despair in relationship to the ecological condition. So I'd love to hear you riff on that a little bit.
Sure. It's also a space where you can't make a rigid, thin distinction between being alive and not being alive. It's a space where there are these specters and spirits and ghosts, like we were talking about, and it's a place where, you know, the difference between a corpse and something that's alive, or something that's just chemicals, or something that's biological, kind of breaks down. But what is this space actually? It's called modern science, right? Like, biology is fundamentally saying that life forms are made of non-life, right? So you can't draw this thin, rigid distinction between them. And that's exactly what happens in kind of charnel ground awareness, right? You're kind of ready to confront a thick region, like populated with all kinds of weird, anomalous, undead creatures. And that's how I think of animism. It's not this firm distinction between life and death, actually. It's accepting that things have this kind of weird, uncanny, slightly paranoia-inducing, but also funny and silly category confusion, or kind of mashing of boundaries or something like that. I mean, there is life and there is death, and things do die and things do live, right? But nevertheless, we can't rigidly distinguish, and it's exactly the same, in fact. It's because of the fact that we can't rigidly distinguish between appearing and being, but in fact there is a difference between appearing and being at the same time. So we encounter these weird, contradictory, uncanny beings, and I think that's much more like what first peoples actually experience, right? A sort of ontological paranoia. And we've been trying to get rid of that paranoia for ages, but maybe there's something true and interesting in that paranoia. You know, when people are diagnosed, like my brother, with schizophrenia, in this culture, they're sort of demonized and pathologized, right? But in another kind of culture, they'd be seen as a potential shaman, because they can kind of bridge worlds, right? And so maybe they need to have some kind of training, right? And so this, or the idea that, you know, in order to see anything at all, you have to be hallucinating, which is actually neurophysiologically correct, right? There's so much more data beaming into your thalamus from inside your brain than is coming into your thalamus from outside of your brain. And if it didn't come from inside your brain, you know, like when you're in a darkened room and you see stuff, you know, like a prisoner in solitary confinement, if that wasn't happening, you couldn't see stuff. And I would argue you couldn't think. You know, I think thinking is basically like a hallucination that you believe in, you know. And then we have to kind of get into the possibility of human-plant coevolution, you know, and the fact that thoughts themselves might be a product of interactions between humans and psychedelic plants, right? This goes back quite some way. So that when you have a thought at all, what's happening actually is a plant, like some kind of version of a plant is happening in your mind, right? Your thought is not your thought. It's more like a flower sort of opening. It's like your way of sort of seeing that, right?
Absolutely, you know, it's just remarkable. I love your stream, man. I don't know what your students. I pity your students trying to like take notes and go, wait, he said something about Kant and then animism. Oh boy, I'm never going to get all this straight. No, but for me, it's all delicious candy. And I mean that in the best sense, in the chocolate we all need to investigate at the moment. And it's amazing to me also how all of this stuff is coming up. All of it's coming back. It's coming back very fast. And when I say coming back, I mean it intentionally, because I do experience this shift that we're talking about, not simply as the latest twist, but as a twist that resonates with things that have been eclipsed. And if the resonance is not the return, it doesn't mean we're going back to animism, we're going back to the Paleolithic, but there are all sorts of resonances about that stretch beyond the modern, and I think Buddhism is a very beautiful way to line up the resonances in an insightful kind of way. And so I really appreciate that. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I just have to ask, I'm just kind of curious how... I mean, it's a whole other question in a way. It's probably the wrong time to ask it, but I'm just curious what your Buddhist practice means to you now. What is it like? Is it something, do you meditate every day? Do you do like in terms of a formal expression of it? Because we talk a lot about practice on this show, and I'm just curious what yours is.
Well, I've been formally studying Buddhism for about 20 years. I've been sort of thinking about it for much longer than that and sort of reading about it and meditating for quite some time. But I've been formally studying it for about 20 years. And what I'm doing right now is the Nyendro, which is the sort of preliminary practices in Tibetan Buddhism. And the reason why I'm doing it is because I'm a student of Dzogchen, which is a form of esoteric Tibetan Buddhism. And the way that it sort of works is that you're doing a lot of visualization of various sort of enlightened beings. And these visualizations, you could sort of think of them as a little bit like allergy medicine. They're sort of allowing you to tolerate this weird, radically kind of withdrawn yet vivid quality of your very own mind, you know, whatever that is, which we do tend to delete. You know, we do tend to sort of ignore it or delete it. We sort of can't believe it's right there, you know. For some reason, these visualization practices, which are a little bit along the lines of this kind of hallucination thing that I'm talking about, are really helpful for sort of allowing you to kind of stay there, wherever that is. Now, the trouble is, of course, I've done quite a lot of meditating, so at this point, it's actually rather hard to describe exactly. like if it was a few years ago, I could probably tell you exactly where I was, but right now it's like being in a long-term relationship. It's like suddenly you're in deep space, and it's like there's no particular rules anymore, or the rules you thought were rules aren't really rules. And so it's a little bit tricky, but I'm sort of kind of relaxing with the idea that since we never actually left what we pejoratively call the Paleolithic, like the word medieval, it's a kind of pejorative term to refer to something that we couldn't possibly be. But the irony is that we actually never left, right? So it's not really paleo anything. It's now. It's right now. It's happening now. We're still in the dream time. You know, we're still there, right? It hasn't gone away. We've just been telling ourselves that it's gone away. Since that's the case, then the only thing to do is to just kind of allow it to happen. And that's functionally equivalent to meditation, where in the end, you know, if you were going to have like a Western explanation of meditation that didn't have any like orientalized looking like people in it, I think the best would be experience is not the same as you, right? There's Tim Morton, right? But then there's experience, and an experience doesn't have Tim. This is a Tim Morton experience kind of stamped all the way through it, you know, and meditation is really about, you know, above and beyond relaxing, which it kind of isn't about. In the end, it's sort of about experience. It's about letting experience happen very, very freely. And what happens when you let it happen very freely is you notice that it's actually suffused with its own kind of stability and its own kind of energy. And actually, it has this compassion in it.
Well, that's a wonderful place. I think we're going to have to end it there, Tim. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. It was a great conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Very good. All right, folks. Until next week. Keep your minds open.